All right, gang, welcome back to the Weekside Podcast. Jenny and I have made it back from Miami to New Jersey, which is oddly like the same temperature, which was like kind of a weird thing, like only a little bit colder. It wasn't like super picturesque in Miami, I think, that week.
I mean, I didn't land in New Jersey. I landed in New York.
True.
You made it back to New Jersey, Connor.
Yeah, I made it back to New Jersey.
Okay.
Jenny made
Just
it back to,
clarify.
To New York. And then we came together to tape our podcast, our kind of Super Bowl wrap-up show, and we'll get into a little bit of everything. You know, Jenny was in the Chiefs locker room after the game, helping kind of chronicle their whole season for our great magazine story that came out. I went with the 49ers after the game, and we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll get into some of the Tom Brady stuff that was thrust upon us, I guess, through various Super Bowl media commercials and ads and all that kind of stuff. And some Jaguars talk, oddly enough, at the end of the Super Bowl recap show. And a little bit of a special treat for you guys at the end, so make sure you stick with it. But I want to start by asking you, because the last time we checked in, it was Tuesday. We were just getting acclimated to the scene. We taped a podcast under the lovely 95 South Interstate at our hotel in Miami. You're back. What is your favorite memory of Super Bowl Live? Your lasting memory?
I was actually pretty close on the score, Connor. I said 31-24, and I almost said 31-21.
Wow.
Chiefs, but you know, missed it. So, but I was in the neighborhood.
Yes.
I think my favorite memory was just watching Andy in the final few minutes of the game. You know, we were sitting in the press box and just took my binoculars and just saw how he was reacting. And when Damian Williams scored what the touchdown that clinched the game, essentially, you know, I thought it was kind of poignant. Andy Reid was just standing there with one finger up, you know, signaling for the extra point that they would go for one, just like coaching till the very end. And through the next several minutes, different players, coaches were coming up to him. You know, he got the orange Gatorade bath dumped on him. You know, Mahomes gave him a long embrace, but they had to get through the end of the game. So he kept reminding, you know, kept signaling for staff and players to get back on the sideline. He was giving Mahomes reminders for the final kneel downs. You know, he was always holding on to his giant play sheet. And then finally, you know, the confetti falls and he can relax and he just totally got swarmed. But I think just kind of watching him in those few moments when you know, like, wow, it's been sealed. Like, this quest of mine for 20 years is finally complete. That was a pretty emotional moment that I was glad that I got to witness.
Yeah. I liked I got to see Patrick Mahomes arrive at the locker room because I was doing 49ers and then they obviously closed down the locker room super early. And so I went over to Chiefs for a minute and to see him arrive and then to go around to all of kind of the people that he was closest with on the team. There was still that energy, you know, he was still wearing all of his gear from the game. Didn't even have time to get rid of that yet. And that was cool. I mean, that's kind of one of those like organic moments where, I don't know, you just do all your little inside jokes with people, but they have a different meaning now because you're Super Bowl champions, you know?
Yeah, there was a lot in that locker room. By the time I made it back in, you know, Andy Reid came into the locker room for the first time about an hour at least after the game ended because he was on the field doing media obligations, but also I think kind of soaking in the moment. And then he went to his press conference. So by the time he finally came in, it was right before the locker room was closed to media, but just sort of seeing him walk through and the joy on his face and probably a little bit of relief. You know, some of his friends said when they saw him hosting the Lamar Hunt Trophy after the AFC Championship game, they saw that sense of relief. And I think that was there a little bit on Sunday night as well.
Did you get the sense that, like, I mean, it was this whole career of people saying he was great, but not in that echelon because he had not won that game. I mean, is this as legacy defining as you think people are making it out to be?
I mean, sure, because it's always a thing on your resume. It's always that box that hasn't been checked. But I don't think it's fair to define him that way. He's a brilliant mind. You know, leading up to the game, I feel like he was a little bit underestimated. There was a predominant media narrative that Kyle Shanahan was a better coach than Andy Reid. And I remember being kind of stumped. We were talking about it walking into the stadium, mm-hmm. Connor. Andy is so creative, pulls from offenses. I mean, you saw there was some story after the game that that weird play where they kind of pirouetted around was from a Rose Bowl in like 1948. I mean,
yeah.
That's Andy. He has a play in his playbook from when he played high school football, like, and the relationships he builds with his players and his quarterbacks, and it takes a lot to win a championship, and of course that's an important measuring stick and it's part of someone's legacy, but I just feel like the things that he's done, you know, it doesn't always work. There's a lot of things that have to come together, and so to see him finally have all of those things come together. But I thought the one of the best reactions leading up to the game, I talked to Chris Ballard, the Colts general manager, who didn't know Andy when he first went to work in Kansas City. He was hired to be under John Dorsey, on John Dorsey's staff, and he and Andy built a relationship over a period of time for a lot of reasons, one of which was, you know, Andy's sons had battled addiction, and Chris Ballard had adopted children from a relative of his that had battled addiction, so they had a kind of common ground there, and they became close, and Chris Ballard would keep this file on his computer of things, of advice that Andy told him. But anyways, I asked him about this idea that Andy needed the Super Bowl to complete his legacy, and Ballard said, just very bluntly, he just goes, that's bullshit. He's a Hall of Famer. And I thought that's a reflection of how people who have seen Andy work and who have been around him feel about him.
The play from the Rose Bowl like opened my eyes a little bit, and it was stunning because, you know, the 49ers, I was surprised, did not look markedly different than what we saw during the regular season, right? They were the 49ers, and they ran the 49ers offense. And it almost reminded me of the Rams a little bit in last year's Super Bowl, where it's like, you got 2 weeks, like, what else did you come up with, you know? Mm-hmm. And Andy Reid's not only doing that, but, I mean, you know, there was that the fourth down conversion and the touchdown were both just, like, early 2000s, like, that speed option stuff that people, nobody defends anymore. And it's just fascinating that he just brings from all these different things and adds. And for as much as Kyle had that reputation as the savant, where was that element of it, right? Like, where was the thing that you weren't expecting?
It was just kind of like we forgot that Andy is the savant. You know, in their game plan, every week they star the plays that are brand new because they don't want to put in too many plays that Mike Kafka, the quarterback's coach, has to really drill down on with his players. They don't want too much new stuff. They have a director of analytics, and his job, one of his jobs, is to count the starred plays and keep it to a reasonable level. And usually the capper is 7. That's what Joe Blaymeyer, their passing game coordinator, said. So, I mean, think about that, though. Every week they're putting in 7 brand new plays. And the reason this came up was in the story that Greg Bishop and I did about the game, there was this one play called Dr. Octopus that we can get into a little bit later, but kind of got into the meaning of this season and that there's so many legs to it for Andy Reid. But that was a play he drew up on a Monday, put it on this infamous whiteboard in his office. Assistants didn't think it was too remarkable, so he said, fine, I'll just add a 5th eligible receiver, which of course you can't have any more than 5. They're like, all right. And because there were so many eligible receivers, like legs, they called it Dr. Octopus. Anyway, so that was one of the starred plays that week, and they had to teach it from scratch. And, you know, but that's every week with Andy Reid building a game plan.
So I want to get right into this, so we'll hop into news topic number one. And so Jenny referenced the print edition of the story you can get in the commemorative issue that's going to come out. It's been online. It's sort of like a Sports Illustrated tradition to write these grand game stories, but the one that you and Greg did just like knocked my socks off. It was so good. And anyone that's interested in the Chiefs, I mean, it's just phenomenal. I mean, the story of how they got here, I've not seen it told anywhere else like this. You have to read it, click on it, anything. So, news topic number one, the Kansas City Chiefs won their first Super Bowl since 1969 on Sunday, kicking off an epic celebration that had deep and significant meaning for Andy Reid as well as many others on their roster. Jenny, as we just mentioned, chronicled their run through the Super Bowl, bore witness to the post-game celebration. I don't know. Take me through that, because we don't want to give away too much of the story because I want everyone to read it. We need to go back to the times when you sat there and you devoured stuff like this, which you should do. But take me through that a little bit, because this was a really special journey, I think, for Andy.
Yeah. You know, he came to Kansas City in 2013 in January. It was 4 days. He interviewed 4 days after he was fired from the Eagles. They had a 4-12 season, and this was 5 months after his son Garrett died of an accidental drug overdose. Meanwhile, the Kansas City Chiefs, this December 1st, 2012, Javon Belcher murders his girlfriend and then kills himself in the parking lot of the Chiefs facility. So the situation, both sides are dealing with kind of unfathomable tragedy and a lot of different parts to that grief, different for each side, obviously. And, you know, I talked to Scott Pioli, who was the general manager at the time for the Chiefs, and he would step down shortly after Andy was hired. But he was in the interview, and he had known Andy a little bit. They had shared some moments when Pioli worked for the Patriots and Andy worked for the Eagles, and they'd built a friendship over the years. And he said even before they interviewed him, that they knew that really the only person that could handle this situation, that could come into a team that was healing and could, you know, be able to build the relationships and be able to lead that healing process, was Andy Reid. And it's interesting that, so I think it adds extra meaning when you kind of come in that situation. You're dealing with a personal loss. The organization is dealing with a tragedy, you know, on a lot of deep levels that people have a hard time understanding and probably many of us will never experience, thankfully. And Andy, you know, changed the organization from the day he walked in. He knew he didn't have to take a year off. Like, for him, he felt that football was his form of therapy, that being around the team, being around that energy was the best thing for him. He feared the emptiness, is what one of his close friends said. So he just kept going, and they kept going together. And so that's where the Dr. Octopus reference came in, because I'd asked Andy if it has greater meaning for both him and for the Chiefs organization, considering that they kind of went on this healing journey together. And you want to be careful. You don't want to equate things, right?
Sure.
Every situation is different, but I do think there are a lot of threads there. And Andy was from a football sense, Andy's chasing a championship. The Chiefs have been chasing a championship. So he said, I named a play Dr. Octopus, and actually I'm thinking of an octopus right now, because there's a lot of legs to this. You know, my son dying, the tragedy here in Kansas City, like us strengthening each other has already happened. And so we're now at this point. And that's why I think for Andy, you know, of course he's been chasing a Super Bowl. This is why he works, you know, from 3 a.m. till 11 p.m. every day, right? But I think that there were so many other parts of this that are more important to him than just one box on his resume. So when you do check that box, and then there's all these other things that you feel like you're coaching and playing for, I think that makes it even more powerful.
I wondered, like, when I saw that, because I mean, it did have a finality to it in the sense that, like you said, I mean, the way that we kind of looked at it, which was not, you know, examining that full picture of his life and what he had done. But, you know, moving forward, it's like, you know, it's interesting to look at this team and think, like, they're still all very young and very talented, and everybody's under contract. The whole staff is coming back. I mean, this could be a very good team for a very long time, and he still seems motivated to do this.
Yeah, I mean, he does seem motivated. That's what everyone around him said, was like having Patrick just totally rejuvenated him, because all of those plays he draws on the whiteboard, Patrick can do every one of them. Mm-hmm. And he's really, this is like new ground for him to have a quarterback that can do whatever you draw up, whatever your crazy mind thinks of on this whiteboard in your office. Patrick can do that. And so, you know, he's not that old. Like, he could coach for a while. And Joe Banner, who was the Eagles team president with him for a long time, said, and they're very close friends, and he said, I just wouldn't be surprised if this was the first of many, that, like, if we look back in 10 years and we'll think how crazy it was that we were thinking that Andy Reid couldn't win a big game.
Right.
You know, he feels, but, you know, it's really hard to make that projection. And of course they've got to, you know, handle the Mahomes contract, which I really don't think will be a big deal. But I think when you have a coach like Andy and you have a quarterback like Patrick, it just sort of makes all of these things seem possible for the near future.
That's how I felt when I started podcasting with Danny and when we brought Shelby on as our producer. It was like all of a sudden the doors opened and the possibilities for our podcasting just felt limitless.
Felt, you know, like a verb for the job. That's what Andy Reid said, you know.
And we're not even close to putting out championship caliber material either here on the Weak Side Podcast.
All right, we'll flip to the other side. The San Francisco 49ers stumbled on the big stage, again putting the spotlight on Kyle Shanahan's game management abilities. Connor was there for the quiet and somber post-game locker room which, for as good as the team might be, did not leave any guarantees that they'd be here again. And Connor, you saw a pretty intimate moment in the locker room. Why don't you start there with what you happened upon?
So I this twice has happened to me at the Super Bowl where there's been like a minor, like odd lapse in security. The first time was after the Patriots lost. When would the Patriots have lost?
I just want to interject and say that no, Connor did not come away with a game-worn jersey here. Let's just say that for the record, because the alarm bells are going off across America.
That would
right
have been
now.
Uncovered in another one of Jenny's great stories, and luckily my name did not surface there. They lost to the, this would have been a while ago, like early pre-Seahawks win. It was one of those early 2000s Patriots. It must have been the Giants, right? It must have been the Giants game that they lost to the Giants, 2010. And I'm like running down the stairs, and I just like zoomed into the locker room because I thought, you know, oh crap, I'm late already. It took me so long to get downstairs.
Okay, so Indianapolis probably.
This is in Indianapolis.
Okay, 2011 yeah. Super Bowl, Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Got it.
And access had not started yet.
Whoa!
So I am just in there with like looking around at 50, you know, more. I mean, 60 just people just sobbing, loudly sobbing. It's quiet. It's dead quiet. And I just look around. I'm like, oh, shit. I'm not supposed to be here. Because
wow.
You see all the other reporters in there and stuff like that. And then you just see this big, like, grizzly man coming up. He's like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm so sorry. This is back before we had to scan into
right.
all this stuff.
Right. Now you have to scan your passes to get into the locker room, which they instituted after the Brady jersey theft.
Yes. So sometimes you just, you know, there's a break in the system and you get led in a different direction. And I was running back to the 49ers locker room, and I got into one door, and you're supposed to go into another door, but I basically walked right into this little room that Kyle Shanahan was sitting in, and it was the size of like a bedroom closet, I would say, with just like a little gray swivel chair. And he's just sitting there, you know, kind of taking a load off for the first time in a while, and Mike and John Lynch are there. They're both drinking Coronas and just, you know, trying to console him, you know, basically like, what else can you do? And maybe out of anyone in that entire place, probably the two people that would at least know what to say in somewhat some way, shape or form. And I thought it was striking. I mean, I guess it says a lot about Kyle's relationship with his dad, but also the relationship that John is trying to develop with Kyle, and sort of the unified front that they're starting to put on. And it was almost like they were the gatekeepers to that room for a little while, because a lot of the assistants wanted to come in and say something. And, you know, it was almost like you had to pass through the two of them to get there. But that was really interesting. And just, I mean, just a very somber locker room. I mean, I think George Kittle was saying that, you know, I know I'm going to be back here. And there was that attitude a little bit, but this team in particular, I think, is going to be hard to replicate. You know, I think that certain things are going to get very expensive for them in a way that they're not going to get for other people. I think you had certain veterans that were hanging on for this moment that might not be back. And I don't know. I mean, it's a fascinating time for the 49ers. I don't really know what to make of them moving forward.
Yeah, Joe Staley is one
that
you mentioned,
yeah.
You know, hanging on for another chance at a championship. And it did feel like this year they overachieved a little bit because they were so bad last year. After Jimmy got hurt, that people kind of forgot about them a little bit. And then when you're overachieving, it's like playing with house money, you know?
Sure.
And like, I think it's easy to feel loose and free when people don't think you're going to be good, or even when you're winning, I got people calling you, you know, paper tigers. What was it? Sorry, just gotta slip that in. I mean, you know, I'm complicit in that too, Connor.
You know what was crazy though, is I was thinking like, you know, so part of the, this is like a industry term, but you know, one of the things that I had to do for the Super Bowl is write the running game story, which is a story that the second that the game is over, you have to turn it in because it's got to go online right away. And so you're writing the game as it's happening. And, you know, there was a version on my laptop of the 49ers winning the Super Bowl, and then a version of the Chiefs winning the Super Bowl, a version that I started at the end, God forbid this thing go into overtime. And then there was a version there. But when I was writing the 49ers winning version, I was thinking, like, this doesn't feel like it's locked up yet. I mean, they're down. Yes, they're up 10 points, but this was a team that could barely beat the Mason Rudolph-led Steelers earlier in the season. And this is the Chiefs. And like, I think it's crazy how through the winding road of the season, we just somehow forgot that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That like, holy crap, it's Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes. And this is like a team that up until the end of the season, like really wasn't that amazing or intimidating, you know?
Yeah. So What do you make of now the second collapse that follows Shanahan and how that will affect him moving forward?
I think that his reasoning, and again, this is 10 minutes after the worst moment of your life. This is the reasoning that you give reporters in a press conference. Mm-hmm. So take that for what it's worth. But I thought it was interesting that he's saying it's 10-10 before the half. The score is tied. And they stop the Chiefs with a minute 45 left. And but they don't use a timeout, right? They have three timeouts left. They don't call a timeout. They could have gotten the ball back with about a minute and 40 seconds to go. And two timeouts. And instead, they just let the play die. They let the Chiefs punt, and they get the ball back with 40 seconds left. That was that drive with the long pass to George Kittle that ended up being called off for offensive pass interference. And Shanahan's ruling there was that we were afraid of giving Patrick Mahomes the ball back before the half because he's so dangerous and he can score at any time. So that's your reasoning there. Flash forward to, I think it was the third quarter when they had the fourth and two, and they didn't go for it, and they kicked the field goal instead of, and he said in that sense, it's like, well, we have to take the points. Well, if you're worried about Patrick Mahomes, you know, don't you think you need to score? Mm-hmm. And is a touchdown is worth more than a field goal? And, you know, I get that, you know, he was killed by the analytics crowd there, and rightfully so. And Andy Reid did all these things on fourth down, which he doesn't normally do, to help him win this game. And I don't know. I just thought, for all of the things that you could have learned from yourself as a play caller from the collapse with the Falcons, it just didn't show. I don't know. It just didn't. It seemed like he didn't operate any differently with the lead than he did in that last Super Bowl, really.
Yeah. I think he went into detail about the decision making. And he also, in the 2 weeks leading up to the Super Bowl, had revisited the 28-3 situation, particularly after the Julio Jones play and what happened there. And I thought gave a good explanation. But I agree with you, Connor, in that I think this is something that, you know, well, maybe you didn't exactly use these words, so I don't want to put words in your mouth. But from my stance, I do think this can be something that lingers, right? Because then every time you're in one of these situations, it gets in your head. And now, one thing I'll allow for is the idea that this is something you could potentially get better at. You know, you could revisit, you can reanalyze, maybe you can have people on this on your coaching staff that are, you know, having input in some of these decisions. But ultimately, when you are the play caller and you're getting into a flow of the game, it's really in your hands. And I think it's hard to get other people to have input. So before the game, we were reporting out both teams for whoever had won. And I had talked to Dan Quinn, and he was talking about how, you know, when you have something like that 28-3 situation, it's a wound and then it becomes a scar. And he remembered kind of the day after it was difficult to talk about, but, you know, he thinks over time you're grateful for the scars. And but I asked him about that specific situation. You know, he's like, yeah, I'm on the headset. He said, I agreed with the call. Like, he said all the right things. This is Dan Quinn is a great guy. But one thing he also did mention is like, hey, when someone's kind of in the flow of the, you kind of have to say something at the start of a series, or you can't say something before every play, right? Yep. So when you're the guy who's making the play calls, it really is all in your hands.
Yeah.
And so is that something that if you get into the situation, you tighten up, is that something you're going to be able to overcome? And I think that's a harder thing to overcome than, say, becoming better in some area of coaching or learning something new or expanding your playbook. Yeah. I think that is a very, like, it's, I think that's something that's hard to coach yourself to do.
Yeah. I mean, think about, you know, all of the resources at his disposal, right? I mean, your dad is a 2-time Super Bowl winning head coach. You're theoretically connected to everybody in the business. You were born into the profession. You've been a ball boy there since you were 11 or 12 years old. Some of that stuff, if it doesn't come, is just maybe not natural. And that's okay. I mean, I think that, you know, other coaches have found ways to around that, whether they have somebody else that they consult during these drives that are on headsets and they help them out a little bit. They check them a little bit. But I don't know. I mean, you know, I think it's one of those things that I was interested in writing about Kyle in that moment in particular, because regardless of what happens in the future, until he proves that he can win a Super Bowl in a game in which he has led, you're almost like Andy Reid for the rest of your career, right? You're someone that people, NFL fans are not known for their nuance, right? They're not people that are like, well, let's consider the big picture here. He is a victim of this circumstance until he overcomes the circumstance.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
For better or worse,
yes.
You know?
It does stick, yes.
Yeah. So I think that this is, it sort of springboards, I think, interestingly, into our third topic, which I wanted to put here for a reason, which is, well, Patrick Mahomes sets off on his corporate-sponsored congratulations tour, the skeptic's eye turns to Jimmy Garoppolo, who went 20 of 31 for 219 yards, a touchdown, and two interceptions. ESPN does a total quarterback rating, which takes into account situational football, down and distance, score, everything, and his quarterback rating for that game was 40.6, and if you're looking at who had a 40.6 quarterback rating on average throughout the 2019 season, we're in Andy Dalton, Gardner Minshew territory, and this is the biggest game of Jimmy Garoppolo's career. So is this a bad sample size? It's just one game? Or is this a long-term problem? Is he good enough to win a Super Bowl with, or have we seen the top of where someone can take Jimmy Garoppolo?
So they went to the Super Bowl with him.
They went to the Super Bowl, yeah.
I think the sequence at the end of the first half was a little bit alarming from the sense of, like, I think that's kind of where this starts from.
Yeah.
When you see them not trying to score
exactly.
in that situation,
exactly.
That's where the questions creep in about how much confidence they have in Garoppolo. You know, earlier in the playoffs, the run game was working so well. So Garoppolo passing 8 times in a game, okay, whatever, and then you hear, you know, he's on the trophy podium with John Lynch, and they're joking about the, hey, I only had to pass 8 times because the run game was working so well.
Right.
That's charming. That's not alarming. It is alarming when your coach fears more Patrick Mahomes coming back on the field
exactly.
than believing that it's worth taking that chance with you.
Yeah.
And, of course, Patrick Mahomes is better than every quarterback in the NFL right now. So, you know, I understand that in a sense, but you can see how a shortcoming or a lack of full confidence can impact a game like this.
Yeah. That's the other side of that is it was sort of stunning that Kyle said that. And, you know, he did make that, the throw to Kittle was a good throw. But then on the flip side, you have at the end of the game, you have Emmanuel Sanders wide open, and you hate to condense the game down to that throw, but you know, we have that vision of the stereotypical game-winning Super Bowl quarterback, and you make that throw. You hit that guy with a step on the cornerback, and he didn't. I mean, it sailed. And I thought Kyle's reaction on the sidelines was a little telling. It was sort of like a, you know, he kind of like swatted his hands at the ground, and it's like, well, shit, this is where we are. And I think it's interesting. It's like, is this, you know, if you're good enough to get to the Super Bowl as someone, you're certainly there to get there. You're certainly good enough to get there again under similar circumstances if things break the right way. But is he ever going to be able to take over games? And can we safely say that about him now? Is he far enough into his career that we can make a judgment on him, do you think?
Yeah, I don't think he's far enough in his career that we can make that definitive judgment. And, you know, he had an ACL tear last year, and you couldn't tell this year. I mean, kudos to him for his, you know,
sure.
rehab and recovery process. But so, you know, he really has it's not like he's been in this system for forever and we think we've seen his ceiling with Shanahan. But I did think that play that you referenced with Sanders and then also, of course, the interception where he's got the infamous picture now of him closing his eyes while he's throwing the ball. And I think that is kind of representative of, like, some of the mistakes that he did make this season. So it's very interesting because I remember going out to Santa Clara, like, right after, you know, he's traded midseason. He comes in. He has these hot 6 starts for the 49ers, and everyone thinks, like, oh my gosh, you know, like, how can you top this? There's you know, this is, we're seeing greatness unfold, you know. And I remember the team was scared of how high those expectations were, knowing that, like, there was just no way that you're going to continue that torrid pace. No quarterback would. Everyone has some kind of, you know, ebbs and flows. But then now it's like totally the opposite. It's just interesting how it's totally flipped. And he was good enough to get them to the Super Bowl. But, you know, we're asking now, like, it's just a different, it's just, I don't know. I'm stumbling over my words here, Connor, but it's just amazing to me how that conversation has flipped. And now we think, well, hey, they have some flexibility at the back end of his contract.
Yeah.
Will they make use of that?
Yeah. I think that's going to be really interesting. Can I add like one random aside in that I just wanted to bring up? On the Mahomes thing and just quarterbacks making plays and big moments and, you know, whatever. And you mentioned Jimmy G closing his eyes during that interception, and it made me think the polar opposite of, you know, when the Chiefs were down and everything was spiraling, Mahomes got that ball swatted away from him, and what does he do? He jumps on it. Like, in that moment, instinctively dives on that in the middle of the rush. And, how, you know, I think that totally blew my mind because you think back to Cam Newton, the Broncos year, where he, like, steps away from it like he wants nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, he's not the, you know, I think part of that is just what is inside of you. You know
totally.
What I mean? And, like, you know, if you're closing your eyes and you're throwing a pass or whatever, but then there's, like, also something inside of you that just snaps and you say, I got to dive for the football, a little bit like... during that last segment when you spilled your tea and then almost spilled it again, and there was zero misstep from you at all. You plowed right through. It was pretty amazing.
You noticed how I almost spilled it a second time.
I did.
Yeah.
But okay. Like flawless. And that was while you were giving a great response to the question. So,
but I mean, still spilled it once. So, you know.
I would call that a recovered fumble. I would liken that to a recovered fumble. I think that's, again, it goes back to the thread that I've been trying to make throughout the show, which is that I have two Patrick Mahomeses with me at all times in this podcast, which is wonderful. I feel great about it.
We have three, Connor. Three in this room.
Thank you.
All right. News topic number four. Surprise. The ominous photo of Tom Brady walking away that he posted on social media was just guerrilla marketing for a major television streaming brand. Ooh, nice not naming this, not giving extra ad time there, Connor.
Screw them.
But if they want to sponsor the pod, sure. Brady was the star of their Super Bowl commercial, which picked up where the photo left off. What do we make of both the ad itself and the fact that Brady's future is still very much up in the air, despite him assuring viewers that he's not going anywhere? What this news topic is missing is that Connor Orr recreated this photo in Coconut Grove on Thursday night. He was walking toward a youth softball field. So it was
true.
Either him retiring from his illustrious softball career in Scranton, Pennsylvania, or walking toward his daughter's budding softball career.
Oh, wow. Wow. Hopefully walking away from, well, maybe both, right?
Probably both.
I would say that the men's softball league
You were in a league recently. Yes,
yeah,
okay.
I would hope that they would hope it was a retirement photo because in terms of like total QBR for me, I'm like a negative. I drag the team down.
Okay, so
I would think that they saw that and thought, please God, maybe that means he's finally leaving the team.
Well, hopefully your daughter, softball would be a great sport.
Yeah.
I could see your daughter really having a knack for that.
Redeeming my end of the family's athletic. Well, I mean, my sister is still a phenomenal athlete. She was a Division I athlete. She's got to help me out a little bit. You know, my daughter, she's got to boost my credentials a little bit. I was very upset about this whole thing for a lot of reasons. The first of which is that I think late in his career, Tom has developed this sensitivity about everything. And it's just like, well, the media is so negative. Jenny just spilled her tea again.
Really, really not my day. Sorry. Anyway, back to Tom.
And so he's, he's always like, you know, kind of painting us as like, cynics, and we're so overcritical. We only look at the negative things. That you utilizing our belief that you might retire as a pivot point to sell television streaming subscriptions confirms our cynicism. This is why we act that way with you, because late in his career, he has become nothing but just a chemical combination of different brands. That's all he is anymore.
Yeah, I didn't like it either, Connor. And I kind of felt like it just kind of, you've been in the last three Super Bowls.
A look at me kind of thing.
Well, it just felt like a little bit like, and he was on the Westwood One broadcast as well, like at halftime and pregame. And so there was a lot of Brady on Super Bowl Sunday. And, you know, it just seemed like maybe that wasn't the right move.
Yeah. And here's the other thing I kind of find laughable about the entire scenario is that we're now starting to hear kind of like the dueling demands of both the Patriots and Brady sort of leaking out here in recent days. And I think on Super Bowl Sunday, NFL Network reported that he wants the team to go shopping and to get him these weapons, and he needs at least $35 million. I think Bill is probably sitting there being like, okay, see you later. You know, I got to get 10 of you guys to replace you. And where is Tom Brady going, right? You need that other end of the spectrum. And all we've heard is Chargers and Raiders. And the Chargers, I think, have a phenomenal coach. They have offensive weapons. I think they could maybe do something special with him. But if the Raiders are the last team on your leverage point, go ahead. Have fun with that. Go from your one-word play calls to play calls that take 6.5 minutes to get out of the huddle. Go have John Gruden criticizing you to the press during the week when he's not happy that you're 3-4. Go ahead. See how that works out. Go live in Las Vegas. Take your family out there.
That would be an interesting swing.
It's a horrible leverage point because there's no comparison.
Yeah.
There's no comparison.
Well, I mean, and that's true, I mean, with a lot of situations, right?
True.
I mean, where would he go? And that's the biggest counterpoints to leaving is
right.
Where would you go that you could just drop in and it's going to be like everything that you're used to? However, if you want a change of scenery and you feel like you just want to do this somewhere else or want a break on whatever level or want more weapons or whatever it may be, and you feel like you have to look elsewhere to do it, it's just, that's why we've said all along, it still feels the likeliest that he would go back, but that's not all in his hands.
Like, I feel like the appeal is, you know, it's in this weird situation where if you're Tom, it's almost like everything you want, you're bargaining with your boss's boss. You're not bargaining, you know, who wants to keep you because you're the face of the franchise, you know? But Bill, who are you to tell him that you need more weapons? Or, you know, who are you to tell him that you need a larger piece of his salary cap? The only reason that you were able to win so many Super Bowls is because the finances were allocated as they were, and the team built this phenomenal middle class. Financial middle class of player that was just one step above a lot of teams in other places. I don't know. I just think it's like, I don't know. And that combined with the fact that, you know, people say there isn't a sample size, but like they went, what, 11-5 with Matt Castle. They won 4 games with Jimmy Garoppolo. They did well with Jacoby Brissett. It's like, I just don't think this is a team that you should be playing hardball with here. I mean, they're going to be successful when you leave. They're absolutely going to be successful when you leave. Which is not to say that you didn't have amazing contributions and work your butt off and become arguably the greatest player in NFL history, but they're still going to be very good when you leave.
Yeah, I'm anxious for this off-season storyline to get wrapped up and to move on to other topics.
My God. Speaking of which, I think we have a good refreshing one for number 5. I think this is like the sorbet course before we get into the steak
cleanser.
Yeah, nice little palate cleanser.
All right, hold on, drop the phone. The Jacksonville Jaguars will now play in London twice next year, going for back-to-back weeks and limiting their home game slate in Northern Florida to 6. Do you think this is the farthest-reaching component of their push to be a global brand, or is this just the beginning? 25% of your home slate abroad.
Fascinating.
Yes. It wasn't home and road. It was home and home.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
It's very interesting.
If I'm a season ticket holder in Jacksonville, I'm obviously furious.
Very angry. Yes.
You know, if that's something that you like to do. I feel like we started our training camp tour there 2 years ago, and we ran into a very affable, loyal fan base, people who have been through some really gross stuff there, you know. And are still hanging on. I would be livid if I were them. You know, I just don't think, how can you, if you're them, think anything other than they're slowly leaving you, right?
Right, right. And it's not a decision that's made with fans in mind.
Sure.
It's made, obviously, for the gate revenues in London, which they need to stay afloat. So I do think we'll see, I could see them playing half of their home games in London.
Really?
I think that's the direction they're headed. Like,
wow.
I think this is a big step, and I think because of this big step, I think that's the direction they're going in.
That's fascinating. You know what might be, though, like a sneaky advantage in their part is, like, say you're over there then for almost half the year eventually, right? And maybe, you know, because their plan has always been, they get there very early, and that's their thing, and they kind of acclimate. At least they did in 2015 when I flew out there for the Bills game. And they've sort of felt, and Doug Marrone said this after their last London series, that they had always kind of felt that they kind of figured it out, how to play in London. They've got the secret, how to, when to fly, what to eat, where to go, you know, how to live out there for an extended period of time. Might be a little bit of a built-in advantage, right? If you're able to do that, if you're able to win that first game, and then by the second week, you're totally acclimated, your body's totally acclimated, and then you get a second team coming in cold. At least maybe that's helpful for a game. I don't know. I don't know if that's something that they're even thinking about.
Yeah, I definitely think that's by design to be consecutive like that, because that way you do have a pretty significant advantage for the second week around.
What do you think? I mean, I agree with your point that maybe this is the prelude to something bigger. But if you, like, for instance, if you listen to, like, talk radio down there, I think there is definitely an adversarial relationship between them and the team. Just the overwhelming thing that they're trying to whip fans up with is that they're going to leave you, right? These guys are leaving you. And they don't care because the owner likes London and he loves the city and everything. And I don't know. I just feel like I would be very careful about that going forward, because you can't afford to just sell your fan base down the road when, you know, you need them right now. You know, this is the time now more than ever where you're trying to convince them to say, hey, we messed some stuff up again, but stick with us this time, you know?
Yeah, all of the efforts over the last several years to build a Jaguars fan club in London, it's just, we've talked about this before, and that, like, I do think there has been a tangible growth in NFL fans in London, mm-hmm. but I just don't believe that it's tied to any one team. They just, yep. Of course we've all seen, you know, the stadiums are, every jersey, every team is represented, and everyone has some random tie to a team that they happen to like. And so the idea of there being a London NFL team or a specific franchise that fans in London are drawn to, I just don't think, you know, as much as they try to force the Jaguars issue, I don't think that will ever be viable. I think they'll continue to sell out a package of games and a package of different teams, and people in London will want to go and see it as a novelty event. I'm just never sure that London is embracing the Jaguars. I just don't see that.
No. And it's like, you know, we heard at the end of the Roger Goodell's State of the Union address that he did on Wednesday of Super Bowl week, kind of ended on two questions. One from a reporter in London that said, hey, when are you going to, you know, just stop dating and marry us here and put a team out there? And Roger Goodell said that there was no timeline, followed up by a reporter from Toronto that Ooh. Said, why have you been ignoring us the whole time? We've been sitting here and we're the perfect place for a franchise. And, you know, Roger said, I love Canada and I love Toronto, but, you know, there's nothing really percolating right now. But I mean, I don't know if these owners need another leverage city to start drumming up business in their own markets or something like that. But mm-hmm. You and I have talked about this for years. I can never see it being London. It's not going to work full time. And I don't know, maybe this is the answer, is to make them think at least part of the time that you're part owner of this one team.
Yeah, I think we talked about it a couple of months ago, how there was a shift in the narrative from the NFL of, hey, we have a timeline for putting a team in London versus what it is now, in that, hey, this is what it is. We've grown a fan base. We feel proud about it, and we'll see where it takes us, which reflects what you said, Goodell said, saying there's no timeline. It's very different from what it was 5 years ago. I did a story then, and, you know, when Mark Waller was in charge of the London growth and the international things, it was, hey, we're on this path to having right. a franchise there. So I think this is kind of like their compromise. And so I've always thought that we would get to a point where there would be like a full home slate package of games, like eight. And I think this is a step toward it. I just think that they're going to have more than one of those be Jaguars games. So now it's two. And so maybe you ultimately get to eight home games in London, and perhaps four of them are Jaguars games.
When I was over there in 2015, my two favorite stories, because you're right, fans just come upon the NFL, sort of like we do with Premier League soccer. Like, I would say that
totally.
There's a connection there.
Yes, it's like very random.
Yes, like I guess I like Arsenal because my brother-in-law is a big Arsenal fan, and they got my daughter like a cute Arsenal jersey, and so we're Arsenal fans now. I mean, that's just how it goes.
If you were interviewed by the UK media, you would give that story. It would be very similar.
Yeah, if you asked me to name six players on the team, I would ask you to spot me five, and you know, you'd go from there. But when I was over there in 2015, you're talking to people in bars, and I met a Jaguars fan, and I said, "Why are you a Jaguars fan?" And he said, "Because you guys pronounce it wrong, and it's just hilarious." And he had a Jalen Ramsey jersey, I remember, and he's just like, it's Jaguars. And he's like, and you guys just constantly.
Oh, that's amazing.
And he's like, you guys say it like, and I'm not going to do a bad British accent, but he did a really funny American accent, and he just goes, Jaguars. and so he said, that's how I became a Jaguars fan, because it's just so funny to listen to you guys just bastardize the language.
That's hilarious.
And the second one was, met this fan, just huge Buffalo Bills fan. And I said, why the Bills? And he said, well, you know, I just got in a, you know, a YouTube wormhole one day, and I started watching these highlights of this Bills running back, and he was just blowing my mind and all the things that he was able to do. And from that moment on, my wife and I haven't missed a game. You know, our kid or whatever has a Bills clothes. We all have Bills jerseys on. And I was like, oh, like Thurman Thomas, you know, I'm thinking like Bill's phenomenal running back. He said, CJ Spiller. And I was like, wow. So from YouTube highlights of CJ Spiller, this person had become a Bills fan. I don't know. It illustrates, I think, to your point that it's never going to be just Jaguars over there, Jaguars, over there. But all right. So we have, this is something that we've been wanting to do all season. As you know, I've been making some really bad Oracle predictions as part of one of our finale segments here. And our crack producer, our Andy Reid, Shelby Royston, has clipped some of my predictions from this season, and he's going to play them back for us. And yeah, I don't know. Take it away, Shelby.
Very excited.
This one's from pretty early in the season.
Oh, boy. I do think that we are at least 3 or 4 weeks away, but not longer than 6 weeks away from an announced, like, Freddie Kitchens is going to say, I'm going to focus more on managing the game and my quarterback, and I'm going to let my offensive coordinator call the plays. I don't feel terrible about that one.
I don't either. You were saying he was essentially about to go down the path toward
saving his job.
Yes.
And he didn't do that.
And
then he got
do
fired.
That. Yes. So I think...
Can I get a half a point for that one?
Let's give you half
a point. All right,
we'll
get a half a point for that one. Okay.
From week 7.
Oh, boy. I'm going to do a quick prediction just because I think, this is the point of this thing, and I'll make a quick prediction, is that going off our Cowboys point, I do think that they're going to swing they're going to make a big trade before the deadline, I think, because that falls in line with the way that they've done things recently, where they're sort of propping this team up in particular. And I think in a post that's going to be up by the time you guys are listening to this, I just speculate maybe Vic Beasley, right? I mean, just something to help them, like they did with Amari Cooper last year. Oh, Michael Bennett, right?
There you go.
No, but that was bad. That was a bad miss. That was a bad miss.
From the following week.
Who is sort of your team that's lurking in the shadows right now? I think that always happens at this point in the season when everything gets sort of log-jammed in the middle. You think you understand the NFL in that given year, and then there's always this team sort of hiding in the shadows, feeling dangerous. Do you want to guess who my team is?
You know, you've been hyping this up for the last hour or so. And so I thought I already asked if it was the Raiders, because I figured like that would be the one where I'd be like, whoa. But you said it's not the Raiders.
It's not. I mean, it's a slightly on brand for me. I mean, this is a team that I've been hyping up, I think, for the better part of 6 years. But I'm going with the Jaguars. Oh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, I got a Jenny Wow on that one, too.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
okay.
Wow.
Wow. Now, that is how you know that I'm not on board with something.
And rightfully so. God, that was really bad.
Here's one, an early season one.
So this one, I'm feeling a little froggy. I'm going to go way out on a limb here.
Okay.
I just put Falcons in the show notes because I wanted to surprise you.
Right. I'm curious.
Atlanta Falcons are 1-4 right now. Dan Quinn, if you read some of the hot takeier sites, is now the next favorite coach to be dismissed in the regular season. Although owner Arthur Blank said it's not going to happen. I think they're going to be 500 by Thanksgiving, and I think that they're going to compete for a playoff spot this year. I think in December we will have substantive discussions about a 1-4 turned around Falcons team in the hunt for the playoffs. I think I just regret saying substantive discussions. They did go on a little run, though,
they
right?
They did go on a run. Dan Quinn kept his job. His players played for him.
They beat
him.
The Saints and the 49ers.
I mean, I would say that they had one of the more remarkable second halves of the season.
If this were like my impeachment hearing and that was placed back to me, the thing that would be put on the cry-on, though, on CNN would be substantive discussions, right?
Yeah.
Or says substantive discussions. That's, and there was
yeah.
no substantive.
Okay, fair.
Maybe like a quarter. Point. Okay, half a point.
Half
okay.
Point. You're at one. I don't know how many we've played, but yeah. 1 point is better than zero.
Yeah, it's better than zero. Yeah.
From week 12.
Oh, boy. So, as everybody knows, Packers' big game this weekend against the San Francisco 49ers. That's the premier matchup. It's going to be in prime time. And the Oracle says that Matt LaFleur and Aaron Rodgers are going to hang a 40 burger on this highly touted 49ers defense. What do you think about that?
They lost 37-8.
Oh, man.
Oh, not only that, but then they got their butts kicked by them again in the NFC Championship game. Yeah, that was our regretted Paper Tiger episode.
That was a Paper Tiger episode, which for the record, I was fully in support of you on. So it was both of us, Connor. We both bear the burden.
Hey, you know, Packers fans, you know, let me hear a little bit of that from you at least. I mean, I was going out on a limb for you guys, and mm-hmm. nobody else was at that point.
That's right.
Remember that.
We have a couple more.
I can't wait. So Dallas and Chicago is Thursday night football this week. I think that Chicago wins this game and Jason Garrett doesn't make it through the weekend.
Half right.
They lost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, yeah, he kept his job for like 3 more weeks.
Yeah. Okay. So another half point, 1.5.
Okay. Yeah. Not too bad. I'm not feeling as bad about that one.
From week 15.
So here's my prediction for this week, and I'm giving myself a little bit of a leeway, which I think is good, but it's coming up. I mean, we have 3 weeks left until the end of the season, which means Black Monday is coming up. The coaching carousel is going to get fired up. And I think that the big buzzword this year in the coaching search is going to be prior head coaching experience. Mike McCarthy. We're going to hear a lot about guys like Mike McCarthy, maybe Mike Shanahan, people who have won Super Bowls or have been to Super Bowls, Ron Rivera. I think that is going to be a big thing. We saw a report on, I think it was NFL Network's Sunday morning show, that Mike McCarthy has already established like a shadow staff, and they've been working on trends. And working on how to defend all this stuff already so that he's ready to go and ready to get hired. I think that after the wave of, hey, everyone who knows Sean McVay gets hired, and that didn't really work out 100%, I think owners are going to start hedging their bets a little bit and saying, no, give me the guy who knows how to do this, who knows how to get there, and I'll work from there.
Oh, okay.
Outside of mentioning Mike Shanahan, which I don't know, why did that even pop in there?
Not sure. but he was a figure that loomed large in January.
True.
And early February.
Ron Rivera and Mike McCarthy.
Yeah, they
though.
Both got jobs.
They both got
Mike
jobs.
Mike McCarthy, you know, because there was some doubt, would he have another opportunity or would he go the way of Brian Billick? So, like 0.25?
0.25, okay.
What are we at now, 1.75?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know what really sucks about this segment is I both hate the sound of my voice and being wrong, and so it's like...
Yeah. This is really torture for you. Okay.
It is fun, though.
We have one more from the very beginning. Let's see if it's come true by
like
now.
Oh, boy. If you're Jerry Jones, if the deal is already on the 90-yard line, you know, or the whatever, the 1-yard line, whatever analogy you want to use, I think... I would not be surprised if in the next week they punch this over the goal line. And that's not me reporting it. That's just me kind of putting some pieces together and saying, you know, this is the from what I've learned of Jerry, from the moments that the Cowboys like to capitalize on, the fact that the deal's already reported close, that they already understand how much guaranteed money roughly is going to be involved in this deal, and they're probably haggling over some finer points. Wouldn't be surprised if the Cowboys have a long-term franchise quarterback here in the next week, maybe before we tape the next podcast. Oh, that's a rough one.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of circumstances have changed since then.
You're being nice.
I'm not being nice. You know how contract negotiations go.
As we sit here, that was, for those of you who can't tell, my hot take on Dak Prescott. I thought for sure that they were going to have signed Dak Prescott, especially then they were on a roll, and
at that time, that seemed like a fair prediction.
Yeah,
yes, that's what I'm saying. You know, circumstances change.
Boy, what's rough season? You know, tough season. I think
I don't think so. I think you know. I think it can't be perfect, Connor.
I had an 8-8. You know, it was sort of a what was it like the Jeff Fisher? It was some 7-9 bullshit. You know. The season was some 7-9 bullshit.
Well, we'll look forward to a better year next year for the Oracle.
Yeah. All you can do is try to get better.
That's right. Know? That's right. One day at a time.
Which is why we should end on a consensus, just something that Jenny can have to bring us together, because it's been a long season, but it's been a good season. We've had highs. We've had lows. We've laughed. We've cried. We started this podcast, which I think was great. I don't know. What do you have to sort of bring us home for 2019, 2020?
I hope that we can all make a pledge together to not get caught up in the Patrick Mahomes extension situation.
Yes.
It's going to happen.
Yes.
It's going to get done. It's going to be big. You know, I talked to Brett Veach in the weeks leading up to the Super Bowl, and I asked him, would a Super Bowl affect the extension talks? And he was kind of like, of course not.
Yeah.
What a silly question. You know, it wouldn't, he said. He's got a resume that speaks for itself already. And I asked about what the timing was. He said, we haven't discussed timing. We have a lot of time to deal with that in the offseason. And the reality is he's just freshly eligible for the contract extension as of the end of the 2019 regular season. There is plenty of time. Both sides are motivated. Everyone wants to get this done. But I just know how these things go. And we're going to be caught in this whole like, oh, my God, it's going poorly. And where are things going to end up? And I just feel like there's just going to be a lot of totally useless headlines before we end up at the inevitable conclusion that Patrick Mahomes will be signed to be the Chiefs franchise quarterback, and everyone will be really happy about it.
God, that is good. I do foresee like the, and this is not making fun of, just an example, like this is not making fun of the outlet. I do think that the outlet does a good job, but like, you know, the Pro Football Talk May 11th thing, it's just like, what could the Chiefs get in a potential trade if they franchise Patrick Mahomes? You know, it's just like, oh my God, it's not going to happen. But, it, you know, everyone is reporting what's happening in the moment and
right,
you know, the right. crazy fluidity of these things. But, God, you're right. That is such a good one. And I think everybody can get on board with that.
I think everyone can. There's always just so much incremental reporting with contract extensions before you reach an inevitable end. And this is one of those that will have an inevitable end, you know. So,
in your reporting career, and I think I can probably guess the answer to this, but what was the most arduous unenjoyable contract reporting scenario that you had to go through?
Well, my first year on the Jets beat was the Revis holdout.
Yep.
Now, I will say that the reporting through that process was fair because he was holding out and things were getting ugly, but you still didn't know they were going to come to some conclusion. But you didn't know what that would be, if it would be the shorter Band-Aid type deal, mm-hmm. the kind of compromise, which it was, or if it would be, you know, a little different structure, maybe a little bit longer. But so that one was very difficult to be newly on a beat. And then, you know, there was a lot of theater to that one. There was the Roscoe Diner.
Yeah.
It was Hard Knocks, of course, so the theater was amplified. And then there was this, like, you know, system where the agents, there were two agents and they would each, you know, start calling down the list of beat writers. And of course, like, they're giving the same information to everybody, But if you're new on the beat, you're like lower on the list. Sure. You're getting the information like 4 minutes after someone else, and they're claiming that it's like breaking exclusive information. And it's like everyone's getting the same thing on like the phone call line.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, what was it like in... Do you remember like when in elementary school or whatever, like if there was swim practice was canceled and there was like a phone tree or
yes.
whatever? That's what it always reminded me of. Like, you're going to find out that practice is canceled. It just may take like a couple extra minutes to get to you.
That's funny. Unless we in Little League, my friend's dad's team, they were coaching in the championship game and every kid has to play. And so the dad orchestrated a little bit of a break in the chain so that Little, and I'm going to change his name for the podcast because I'm sure this person would get worked up about it, and I don't feel sorry for them. But, you know, Little Danny was going to show up at the park on Thursday and the game already happened on Wednesday. And whoops, you know, so sad. Won the
wow.
championship without you. And they did. They were unstoppable that year. They were very talented team. But yeah, they kind of orchestrated a little bit of a break in the chain, told the last guy that, hey, tell this guy, the last guy, so then they could get one step away from, you know, blame on it. And oh yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so the takeaway from that is sometimes there are nefarious situations
sure.
such as that. But generally the phone tree goes according to plan. The Patrick Mahomes situation is not going to be a nefarious one.
Yes.
It will get done.
Yes. I think that's great. And so we're going to get back into Bachelor stuff next week. Jenny and I are still getting caught up, and it's crazy because you're in this whirlwind of the Super Bowl and everything. It gets focused on that. And if you don't believe me, again, I mean, I can't make enough plugs for the story that Jenny and Greg did on the Super Bowl. That should tell you the focus is so in the moment for this wonderful story that, you know, you can't come up for air to see what's going on with Pilot Pete. You just can't do it. And we emerge from the Super Bowl and like all we see are headlines of like mental breakdown, controversy, someone's leaving and coming back. And so we just got to get it. We got to get a couple weeks to grind some tape and we'll be back.
We've got to grind some tape.
Yeah.
In the meantime, yes, readers should also check out Connor's excellent work from Super Bowl week. Kyle Shanahan as a scout team quarterback, the post-game scene of Kyle with
they
Lynch and
Mike.
They
should just put Kyle in that game. He should have just played the end of that game.
The history with Hank Stram coming up with plays on his float in his pool. You had a great Super Bowl week, Connor. So hopefully people who are listening to the show can go back and read some of those stories.
And tell us what do you want to hear for the rest of the season, off season, into the combine and the draft? How can we better serve you guys? We have a wonderful community of people that reached out to us on Twitter. So feel free to keep conversing with us. We love hearing from you.
Yeah, because if people don't reach out, we're liable to just talk about The Bachelor for 45 minutes. And I don't really think anyone wants that. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. The MMQB Weekside Podcast is me, Jenny Vrentis, and Connor Orr. We are produced by Shelby Royston, who you heard on this week's episode. SI's executive producer of podcast is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Marivic is emeritus executive director of the MMQB. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.
And before we go, just a goodbye and a thank you and a good luck to our wonderful editor, Bette Marston, who is leaving us for Runner's World and Bicycle Magazine, too. She's been at a stellar 8.5-year career at Sports Illustrated, was definitely the glue for the MMQB staff, was always here grinding with us, always, you know, was great on podcasts. I'm sure you guys have heard her on several of the podcasts on here. Bette, we loved working with you. We'll miss you dearly and can't wait to hang out sometime soon.
Yeah. Well said, Connor. Thank you so much, Beth.